Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, this week we're going to talk with a blind skier, Stacy Minella, and her coach, Kim Sievers, who participated in the Sochi Olympics. They have some great stories to tell us about what it was like participating in this event and being in Sochi.
And we will hear not just about the skiing, but about all different aspects of being there. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Stacy Minella.
If you work hard, you can do whatever you want.
And as you listen to the rest of this interview with Stacy and Kim, keep that in mind. You'll see how Stacy, despite her visual impairment, has managed to become an excellent world-class skier. And also, despite all the time that takes up in her getting ready for her skiing events and practicing for her skiing events, has also become an excellent student.
And as she said, if you work hard, you can do pretty much anything you want. Well, she worked very hard to get to the Paralympics with her coach and guide, Kim Sievers, who also had to work very hard in order for the two of them to achieve this. Let's start by meeting Stacy and Kim and learning a bit about how they ski together.
I'm Stacy Minella, and I'm a Paralympic alpine skier. I'm visually impaired, and I just came back from the Sochi Paralympic Games.
Which is just so exciting, and that's what we're going to want to be talking about most of this show.
I'm Kim Sievers. I'm Stacy's guide on the race course.
So, Kim, tell us what you do as Stacy's guide.
My role with Stacy is essentially to be her eyes when we're skiing and training. So I have to figure out what things are going to affect how well she skis, the terrain, different changes in snow conditions, the pitch of the slope, you know, a big divot where somebody fell or left a track, a deep track or something like that. And I need to be looking ahead and say, oh, here comes a drop. Stacy needs to know about that in 3 seconds, 2, 1. And so I need to just be communicating all that stuff to her through the microphones that we have in our helmets. And then on the race course, you throw in the gates. So all that other stuff I still need to be thinking about, but I'm telling her where to change her ski edges so that she can be the fastest down the course that she can be.
Now, we learned in a previous show that we did with Stacy and Kim that Stacy's visual impairment makes it particularly difficult for her in bright light, so she wears darkening contact lenses as well as darkening goggles when she skis, and she really can't see much out on the ski slopes. And if you want to listen to that show, which talks more in detail about their techniques of how they actually get down the slopes, that's show 1203, and we will have a link to that in the show notes for this show.
How long have you two been skiing together?
6 seasons.
And this is part of some program that you're part of, right?
Yeah, I'm a grant writer for the Adaptive Sports Foundation, which is at Wyndham Mountain in Wyndham, New York. And Stacy's family has been coming up here since she was 4 years old, and she was a student in our program.
So, Stacy, you also mentioned to us before the interview that you're a senior in high school and you just got accepted to college. Can you tell people a little about that?
I did, yeah. I got accepted early decision to Dartmouth, which is pretty exciting. So that's where I'll be next fall. And it's a really good ski school. I mean, it's a good school too, but there's a lot of skiers there. So I have a lot of opportunities to continue racing, and I'm pretty excited.
And besides the skiing, what are you going to be majoring in? Do you know?
No, I want to do a pre-vet track, but I'm not totally sure. Something in the sciences, but I'm going to go in undecided.
I assume you're going to ski with the ski team when you're there?
Yeah, so I won't ski on the team, but I'll ski and train with them. just to get on snow and get in gates and that kind of thing, especially next year when I'm not going to be on the World Cup circuit because I'm going to stay in school the winter term. I'll definitely train with them a little bit. And then after that, the Dartmouth plan actually allows me to take off the winter term and go to school over the summer. So I'll try and see if I can do that.
That will work out well for your skiing, won't it?
Yeah, exactly. So it makes it a lot easier to be able to ski and keep up with school.
You said you won't be skiing on the ski team. Why not?
Because it's an NCAA team, I can't really ski with them because I'm never going to be as fast as the guys who can see. I can ski with them, but I can't ski for them. Like, I can't race for them.
Yeah, but that's nice. You get to train with them. That should be kind of fun.
Yeah, I talked with the coach when I went to visit the school before I applied, and he was all for it. So that's exciting.
So now, in the last show we did with you guys, you described some of the equipment you use and how you talk to each other going down the slopes. And you said at the time you'd been clocked at 55 miles an hour. I assume you've gotten better since then, which means you're going even faster?
Yeah, we haven't actually had too much stuff with the radar gun recently. But our most recent, we got clocked at 60. Give me a little time, though. I think I can do better. We just haven't had the gun out, really.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is preparing for, participating in, and competing in the 2014 Sochi Paralympic Games. The last time we interviewed you was a little over 2 years ago. You were a sophomore in high school, and you were all excited. You had all these plans for everything you needed to do to make it onto the United States Paralympic team. Now that you've done all of that, can you review what it was that you had to do in order to make the team?
Yeah. So as a sophomore, what was I on the U.S. development team then?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, like I had just made the development teams. I've worked pretty hard since then. I had to qualify for World Cups in points, and I did that last year. And then since then, I've skied a couple World Cup series. I won a World Cup gold medal, actually, in New Zealand. It was actually my first ever World Cup race, and I ended up coming home with a gold, so that was exciting. And to make the Sochi team, we only had 9 spots for the girls. All the girls, not just the visually impaired girls. So I had to be in the top 9 girls in the country, and somehow we managed to do that. So Sochi was pretty cool.
I understand it took you a long time to get there. It wasn't a simple flight from New Jersey to Sochi.
Well, we flew out of Newark to Munich, Germany. And then in Germany, we stayed there for a day, and we did team processing, which is basically when we get all of our stuff. We got like 2 full suitcases of Team USA stuff. And then from Germany the next day, we had a charter flight. So it was just our team, and we flew Munich into Sochi.
How long were you at Sochi before the games began?
So we were there 6 days early. We got to get on snow and train a little bit, get used to everything, get unpacked. And then opening ceremonies was March 7th.
They start doing the downhill training runs before the opening ceremonies. So our team was actually on snow racing 3 days before the opening ceremonies.
On the actual courses or on other courses?
Yeah, on the downhill course. We didn't ski the downhill, so we weren't doing that, but some of our teammates skied it, and they have to ski a training run, at least one training run, in order to race. So yeah, they set the course and they run it a couple times before they actually do the race.
Were there any differences between the courses that you raced and the courses the other Olympics did a week or two earlier?
Actually, the downhill that we ran was the men's downhill from the Olympics. It started a little bit further down, but it was the men's hill, not the women's hill, because on the women's hill, there was a big left fall away, and they thought that the amputees that had their left foot had a way bigger advantage over the ones who had their right foot, and so they put all the disabled athletes on the men's hill.
How did it compare to other places where you've skied, for example, in the World Cup?
Well, I mean, I think the difference is that this was a real Olympic downhill. On the World Cup circuit, the hills vary, but it's not very often that we're on an Olympic men's downhill. Like, it's just not.
And it was so steep.
It intimidated a lot of people.
When you see a new hill like that for the first time, do you sort of go through it slowly and sort of learn the turns?
Well, since we didn't ski the speed events, all we skied was the GS and the slalom. The day that I saw the hill for the first time was the day that I raced on it. And we have what's called an inspection, and every racer has it, like even able-bodied racers. So we get to slip through the course a little bit before we actually run it. And since the snow wasn't all that great, they closed off the steep parts of the hill. So I never got to ski on and feel the steeper parts of the hill until we were running the GS.
So she referred to the GS. That's the Giant Slalom Race, which, according to Wikipedia, is an alpine skiing discipline which involves skiing between sets of poles or gates spaced at a greater distance from each other than in the slalom events, but at a shorter distance from each other than in the Super G. And the Giant Slalom and slalom make up the technical events in alpine ski racing.
You said you didn't quite get to see or assess the course as fully as you would like to ahead of time. Is that common with these things, or do you usually have a better understanding of the course beforehand?
When the snow isn't as good as it should be to run a race, it's common to see them block off parts of a course or have us do what's called an in-and-out inspection, which basically means that we can slip down the side of the course, but we can't slip in it. And that kind of stinks when you can't see, because for me, the only time I'm really getting a feel for what the course is going to be like is when I'm slipping through it. I don't really like to not be able to feel how steep it's going to be right here or what the snow condition is going to be. And so that's a little bit tough, but that's why I have a guide, I guess.
This was unusual in that they had the two steeps, Bear's Brow and Lake Jump, fenced off completely. So you could look over the edge, but you couldn't even slip down the side of it. And that's unusual. So we didn't have any clue how steep the pitch was going to feel and what the snow was going to feel like and stuff like that. And the other women that had already been on it for Super G and Super Combined and downhill, you know, had done 10 runs on it.
That's a considerable advantage, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what our first run was, pretty slow. Mm-hmm. And the second run, once we felt it and Stacy decided, we skied like babies the first run, and our second run was fourth fastest time.
Wow.
So you were what, like a tenth of a second off getting a medal?
We were out of third by 1 second and we were out of first by four.
Wow.
We couldn't overcome the deficit that we had made
the first run. Very poorly the first run.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. If you hadn't been able to see the course or at least test it out, you'd at least like some practice ahead of time.
Yeah. And so that's tough, but that's racing, so.
So what else did you do in Sochi besides ski? Did you get a chance to sightsee or see any part of the city?
A little bit. So we hung out in Rosa Couture a lot, which was the city in the mountain village. So we explored there a lot. We got to go down to the coastal village where all the sled hockey and curlers stayed. So we walked around there. What else did we do? We walked around our athlete village a lot. There's a lot going on in there.
We ate, we slept.
Yeah.
Athletes do a lot of both of those.
Yeah.
You must have been pretty excited though. Did you really get a good sleep every night, or?
I slept well every night. I don't know about Kim.
I didn't. Our bathroom had a fan in it that was really, really loud, but they had neglected to install an on-off switch, and my bed was right up against it. So after two nights when I didn't get any sleep, I finally went and asked if there was a maintenance program or something, and they said, oh, yeah, yeah. So the solution was to duct tape the vent, but it didn't turn it off, so all it did was kind of make it rattle a little bit more.
Oh, geez.
Terrific.
Yeah. I didn't get as much sleep as maybe Stacy did. She was on the other side of the room.
I can sleep through anything.
So I take it the language was not an issue.
Not usually. A lot of the volunteers were really nice. If they were like sending us towards buses, they would learn how to just say that phrase in English. And sometimes if we were out of the athlete village, like trying to order food or something, was a bit tough, but a lot of the times the language barrier wasn't a huge deal, because in the village all the volunteers tried really hard to allow us to understand what they were saying. So they would learn like specific phrases that they needed to help us get to where we needed to be.
The volunteers were awesome.
Yeah, they were pretty cool.
They gave us Russian lessons in the cafeteria every day. They'd have a sheet and they'd have four or five words on it. They'd make you practice and everything. And about the sixth or seventh day, they started having Russian exams. They did really well on it. They would take your picture and put it up on the wall.
So, okay, Stacy, we have a bunch of listeners in Russia. What can you say in Russian?
Спасибо. Привет.
Пока. That was the extent of mine. We got hello, goodbye, and thank you.
So what other special accommodations did they have to make around the facilities for the Paralympic teams?
They put up a bunch of ramps to let the wheelies get in and out. There was a couple of wheelchair accessible rooms. For the VIs, actually, it was a bit tough to get around. Like, the steps kind of, like, there was no contrast at all. My first few days there, I was like, where are the steps? Like, what is going on here?
They had a ton of accessible vehicles there. We had to leave the athletes' village to go over to the ski center. They had vans running every 5 minutes that had lifts in them.
Yeah, so that was cool.
These guys with the VIs, when we went to the opening ceremony, they gave them an earpiece that had a description of everything that was going on the floor, which was awesome because where they sat us, while it was in the front row and it was really cool to be so close, we were down below the stage level. So all we could really see was feet.
Oh, geez.
So Stacy and Lindsay and, you know, all the visually impaired athletes had this earpiece in that was telling them what the symbolism of everything that was going on. And so they were keeping everybody filled in.
And we were waiting to go, when we were lined up waiting to go to march during opening ceremonies, like we had our earpieces in and we were like, all right, Australia's going in, guys. Like, and we knew exactly where they were, so we knew we were going soon. So that was cool.
So you talked about them not making much accommodations for the VIs, the visually impaired people. Were there people there with guide dogs? Was that allowed?
Yeah, actually, our one teammate brought a guide dog.
It was tough getting him in.
Yeah, it was hard to get in because of visas and stuff and paperwork and all that kind of stuff. So, but she did it, and she had a dog with her.
Speaking of which, I understand you're about to get a guide dog.
I am, actually.
What was your thinking behind that? You've been using a cane for quite a while at this point.
Yeah, I use my cane when I'm traveling alone. And right now, I'm not alone all that often. And I usually end up just following someone. But I'm going off to school in the fall. And I know I'm going to be in places by myself for the first time. And I think it will just be better to have a dog and a lot easier to learn campus and learn different places when I don't have to worry about what's underneath my feet and I can kind of figure out where I am as opposed to, oh, where's that step? You know what I mean?
Well, good.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I hope that goes well for you.
Yeah, I'm excited.
How was the food?
The food was awful. We ate sushi and pizza for 2 straight weeks.
Yeah, the food wasn't the best food I've ever eaten. I'm happy to be back and have some American food.
Oh, that's funny. So most of the food, I mean, sushi and pizza are not Russian indigenous cuisine. Was most of the food Russian or just their best guess at what the athletes would want?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was their best guess. And it wasn't terrible. It was a good effort. We all found things that we liked and we just ate that every day and it worked out.
Everybody ate exactly the same thing every day because you ate it, you know, you didn't get sick or you didn't get an upset stomach or something, so you knew it was safe.
Well, that's interesting for an athlete. I mean, usually, you know, many athletes try to control their diet, and especially before a big event like that, you know, you want to worry about your energy levels and how your stomach's feeling.
Yeah, it was hard to get food that, like, would fill you up. It wasn't, like, the best way to energize before a race. It wasn't my first
choice. Yeah, I don't think I had more than 10 grams of protein the whole time.
Yeah,
we were
like,
there.
I would eat lunch, and then at, like, 2 o'clock, and by, like, 5, I was already hungry, like, really hungry for dinner.
Oh,
so, like, it was hard to get filled up on that food. And it was hard for me to go around and find the food that I thought I was getting, like, in the beginning of the week, before I knew where everything was, like, I kept bringing, like, weird things back to the table. It got a little interesting sometimes. I once put mayonnaise on my salad because I thought it was dressing.
Oh, geez.
Oops.
Yeah. Oh, well.
We usually caught her before she tried it, though.
Yeah. But it was also hard with the language barrier with some of the volunteers because for some reason they were very insistent on serving the food for you. Like, you couldn't grab, like, there were spoons and utensils in all the dishes, but, like, I couldn't grab the utensil and put it on my own plate. Like, they wanted to do it themselves. And so that was kind of hard because I didn't really know what they were putting on my plate most of the time. But that's all right. I managed. I found the sushi and pizza.
It sounds like you're still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, we made it.
What was security like for the athletes?
We were very, very protected.
Yeah.
Where we were.
Protected in what way?
Just security-wise. When we first encountered it, we thought it was a little bizarre. But it actually was very, very effective. When we would go from one secure area to another secure area, like when we would leave the athletes' village, which was secure, and go out on the road to go over to the ski area, which was secure, you'd get in the van and we had credentials that we had to wear everywhere. And they would come in and they would scan everybody and count. And then they would tape the van shut.
Wow.
They would put tape over every possible opening in the van. So they put it over the hood and over the trunk and the windows. And if there was a, you know, a vent up in the top of the van, it was taped shut. And then they would go to the other, to the next venue. And when we would get there, they would had mirrors and they would check under the van and over the van. And they would check all the tape and make sure that all the tape was still intact. Then they would break it and come in and count everybody in the van and scan our credentials again and then go in. So every single time we left a secure area, we had to go through that.
Did seeing that type of security make you feel safer or less safe?
I think safer.
Yeah, safer.
The snipers on the side of the road, you knew you were safe.
As long as they had their rifles pointed the right way.
The rifles were pointed in the right direction.
There was a huge, huge military presence there. So I felt safe.
I think everyone, all the athletes who were in the athlete village felt safe.
In going not only to the Olympics, but you've got other events that you went to earlier in the season and other events you're going to after this interview, you're missing quite a bit of high school. How have you worked out your studies?
Up until this year, I had just juggled it. I was taking like 5 honors classes last year and I was emailing my teachers back and forth and I missed like 30 days of school and I was all over the place last year, but I managed to do pretty well. And then this year, since I did need to commit a little bit more closer to full time, it still wasn't totally full time, but it was closer. So I decided to I'm taking 3 classes online. And so I go to school every other day. Because my school has block scheduling, so we have A and B days, and I only go on B days. And then on the A days, I can actually stay home and work on my online stuff. And if I'm traveling, it's not as big of a deal because I'm really only missing a few classes. And it just ended up working out really well. My school has been really awesome, and I probably couldn't have been here without them. So I'm pretty grateful to have such an awesome support group back home.
These online classes, are they through your high school or a local college or what?
They're through an online school that my school gave me and recommended for me.
So it's actually a high school that does online learning.
Yeah.
Oh.
Did you have to do any homework in Sochi?
No, I didn't do anything in Sochi, and now I'm way behind.
Yeah, well, fortunately, you already got into college.
Yeah, very true. It hasn't been like, oh, I'm a skier, so I don't have to do school. That's never really been an option. So,
well, it's good that you're able to do both. That's a tough task to handle both at the levels that you do. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now for this week's final item, how to learn more about Stacy Minella and Kim Sievers in particular and adaptive ski programs in general. If people want to get involved in adaptive skiing, where would they find more information or a program they can participate in?
The contact information for the Adaptive Sports Foundation is www.adaptivesportsfoundation.org. And if you have a question or anything, you can send an email to info@adaptivesportsfoundation.org. On the website, there's all kinds of information about our programs and lesson times, lesson costs, things like that.
You can also find more information on me and my racing career at stacymanella.com, stacimanella.com.
Now, Stacy, you posted a number of things on Facebook during the Olympics. Can you give your Facebook page?
Yes. So my Facebook page is the Stacy Manella athlete page. I also have Twitter. My handle is StacySkier96 and Instagram, same thing, StacySkier96.
Well, that's exciting, guys. That's great. You worked hard to get there for so long. You made it there, and it sounded like a really fun experience.
Yeah, it was really awesome.
It was good.
If you'd like to watch Stacy and Kim skiing at the Paralympics, go to YouTube and search for Stacy Manella Paralympics, and you'll find lots of videos of the two of them skiing. And if you want to read more about Stacy and Kim on opening weekend of the Paralympics Games, the New York Times posted a nice article featuring the two of them. And that's too long of a link to read, but we will have that in the show notes for this show.
And as usual, we'll have links to all the other contact information you heard, because people don't normally have enough time to write that down during the show, but just go to our show notes associated with this show at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can find all of that information, and you can sign up to join our email listener forum for weekly announcements of upcoming shows, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and there's lots of other resources at the website, so check it out.
That's it for show number 1415. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the accessibility of the Kindle Fire. The Kindle Fire is a recently announced, modestly sized and priced tablet that is internet capable, portable, and versatile. We'll talk with Access Anna, who recently bought one, about its capabilities and accessibility. The built-in speech output, screen magnifier, and touchscreen feedback enable access to the vast majority of features. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpy and Peter Torpy, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and Audioboo at Eyes on Success, and on Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.